STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
You are listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel, the Student Impact Director here at Stand to Reason, sitting in for Greg Kokel, who is traveling to a Ligonier conference in Orlando, Florida. And so I'm glad to join you this hour. We have actually a fascinating conversation here. I've got a special guest with me. His name is Tom Gilson. Tom Gilson is the senior editor and ministry coordinator at TheStream.com, which is a great website with great content. He's ThinkingChristian.net is his blog. He's the author of a couple of books, editor of True Reason. He's a strategist. He's a speaker. He's a writer. He's worked with several great ministries like Ratio Christi and Campus Crusade and others as well. Tom, welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you on here. Tom, are you there? Tom, are you there?
I'm here.
There we go. We got to get the right button. You know, I'm sorry. I'm not a pro like Greg at this, so I got to remember which are the right buttons to push here.
Yeah, that's okay.
But Tom, glad to be speaking to you today about this. And of course, you and I know each other, and have been at events together and stuff. You wrote recently a book. It's entitled "Critical Conversations: A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Teens." So, give us a quick overview of this, Tom.
Sure. And by the way, thanks for having me on. Want to just make sure that listeners know that the website that I work with is stream.org.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's
about that.
Close enough. I think stream.com will get you there, but okay. stream.org is the official address. Anyway, and it is a great group of people to work with. I really love it there. Critical Conversations is a book that was born out of my blogging, where I was trying to connect with parents. And I was also trying to figure out what could somebody do that really helps meet a need where people live. And it's also born out of the part of the blogging that I was doing where I was interacting a lot on the issue of homosexuality and the study I was doing in different books and realizing that there's an awful lot of really good answers out there to the hard questions about homosexuality. But there's an awful lot of really hard challenges being pulled up against all of us that seem really daunting. That the kinds of accusations that get made against Christians because we're not in favor of the pro-LGBT agenda, and I started to think about parents and teens and whether they're equipped to handle this, and I thought, you know, someone ought to be able to help them in a very practical, down-to-earth way to help teens navigate all the challenges that they've got.
Yeah,
in this crazy world we're living in now.
Yeah. Now, on this particular issue, what's your experience? Do you think teens and parents, generally speaking, in the church, are equipped for this issue? What's been your experience?
I don't think so. And part of the reason I can say that is because the numbers show that even within the church, there are a lot of, you know, it's a substantial majority of teens who are wondering whether the church is right to be in opposition to homosexuality. There's a lot of teens, probably three-quarters of teens think that homosexuality is perfectly okay. And
let me clarify there. When you say three-quarter of teens, are you Are you referring to teens within the church, or is that outside of the church?
That would be teens overall, and that's probably a low number.
Mm-hmm.
But because the numbers keep rising, and I think I'm thinking of numbers that were done 5 to 8 years, 6 years ago.
Mm.
There's a large proportion of teens who are in the peer pressure, the sense that the teen is standing in the middle between the culture, the music, the friends, the school, everything, that says one thing, and the church is saying another, and how in the world are they going to sort out what's the right answer?
Yeah, yeah. Now, Tom, as a parent yourself, right, you've got parents. You've got parents. Of course you've got parents, but you also have kids.
I do.
What do you find are some of the obstacles? And in fact, you write this kind of early on in your book, you write about some of the obstacles that parents face on this. And I think that's a good thing to think through. What are some of the things that kind of hinder these kind of conversations with our children on topics like homosexuality?
Yeah, actually, the first part of the answer to the question of how parents can interact with teens on a hard question of homosexuality is how parents can interact with teens at all.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to hard questions. In homosexuality, this question is almost a perfect storm of the hardest questions because it's culturally, it's a huge question culturally. There's intergenerational differences, and it's about sex.
Hmm.
So this one's maybe the hardest one. But what happens so often with teens and with parents is that the teens have come to the conclusion that the parents don't get it. They're unaware. They're uninvolved, they are behind the times, and the parents are probably, in many cases, thinking, well, that's actually true. I'm really not up to speed on these kinds of things. It's hard to talk with kids about sex, and it's really hard when I don't know what I'm talking about.
Mm.
There's so much confusion around this issue in particular.
Yes.
That to enter into a conversation about it is frightening for parents. What do I do if a kid asks me a question that I can't answer?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I think that is the starting point, is kind of knowing your own view on this. I just talked recently to a dad who said his daughter, college-age daughter, they were driving, and she kind of raised this issue and said, I think gay people are born this way.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't engage in that conversation because he didn't know what to say. He hadn't ever kind of looked at this himself. So there's got to be a basic knowledge base that parents have to have,
right,
in order to be able to discuss these things kind of intelligently and rationally and carefully with their kids. So
yeah, and what parents are competing with there is a knowledge base kids have, which seems to the kids to be overpoweringly convincing, whether it's right or not. And so when a parent comes up against it and the teenager says, wait a minute, that's just not what I learned at school, or that's not what they're saying somewhere else, if the parent doesn't have the equipping to say, wait a minute, that's not quite right, the parent is often tongue-tied. What are they going to say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and oftentimes parents can, even if they don't have something to say, they can start with questions, because I think you're right, they're hearing a lot out there, but often they're being socialized by the culture, so it's not like they're getting a kind of a deep knowledge base themselves on different views. They've heard a few slogans that they're kind of throwing out at their parents, and so a parent can simply respond by saying, well, let me ask you a few questions. Why do you think that? So you think gay people are born that way? Why do you think that? Is there particular studies that you've heard that have been cited, and help kids? And it's, I think, a good way to help kids understand and see that they don't have very strong views themselves about this.
Sure.
Beyond the kind of the cliches.
Of course, you skipped the question there, Brett, which is what do you mean by that? And then how did you come to that conclusion?
Right. Well,
yeah.
If you need that clarification, absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure most of everybody listening here know that comes from Greg's book, Tactics.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway.
So this is a difficult conversation. I think you're right. I think the whole topic of sexuality has been a difficult one in the church, unfortunately, and between Christian kids and their parents. But we got to have the, those conversations. I was just at a church this past weekend, and I said, I was speaking to a group of students and parents, and I said, I wish we in the church would have more conversations about sexuality.
Yeah.
So that we're not reactive,
right,
but that we're proactive. And I think that's why your book is so good, because it's going to help parents to be proactive in this. Now, part one, you actually give what you call essential background.
Right.
And I think this is part of that knowledge base that we were talking about. But give us an overview. What is the essential background a parent needs to have in order to engage in this kind of conversation with their kid?
Well, there's two parts of it. One is understanding the biblical and what I call the common experience reasons I hate this word, but I'll use it in this context, traditional morality. It's actually biblical morality. It's actually common experience morality, but I already use those words in that sentence. But anyway, the parent needs to know why it's right for sex to be for a man and woman who are married to each other, and why it doesn't fit anywhere else. And so that gets into, that's not just whether homosexual activity is right or wrong. It's also whether any sexual activity outside the bonds of a marriage between a man and a woman is good. Mm-hmm. So there's biblical reasons why we know that that's good, and there's also common experience reasons why we know that it's best for marriage to be for a man and woman, and best for sexual relationships to be in that context. That's part of what I cover in the essential background, and the other part of it is a quick and really brief and compressed historical overview of how we got in this mess in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that we came to a position you go back 20, 25 years, nobody ever thought about gay marriage, and now it's very much culturally unacceptable not to be in favor of it.
Yeah.
How did that happen so fast? And as it turns out, the movement was greased on its rails by the sexual revolution of the 60s, in my opinion, but it was also pushed along by a fairly you could almost call it not just homosexual advocacy, but almost insurgency that was pushing an agenda on the country very strategically, very intentionally, and not very nice about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helps parents to know that when kids are confronted with the idea that Christianity isn't very nice, that there's a history behind that, and we're not very nice for opposing equality. Well, there's a history behind that, and it helps to have that background.
Yeah, yeah, and I think and one thing I think that is very valuable about your book is your chapter 3 and what you've already mentioned. Chapter 3 is entitled "What Marriage Is," and you lay out this context of marriage for the particular issue of homosexuality, and I think that's something that the church, generally speaking, probably has not done a good job on, and has kind of been responsive and reactive to the issue of homosexuality. My view is that this is not the issue that we raised. This is the issue the culture raised, and so
yep,
we're responding to it.
Mm-hmm.
But as we respond to it, I think we have just kind of focused in on homosexuality, which is actually, we're saying this is a subset of larger views on sexuality.
Yes.
And in order to discuss something like same-sex marriage and homosexual behavior, what we need to do first is paint a picture of what marriage is,
mm-hmm,
and the biblical plan. So give us a little overview. What do you cover in that chapter? What's a parent need to know about what marriage is as they communicate
okay
this to their kids?
Well, and by the way, going back even into deeper history, the Christian church, going back centuries, has hammered out its beliefs and its doctrines in response to challenges. Over and over and over again, a challenge has arisen, and in time the church said, wait a minute, we need to figure out an answer to this, and they have. We're in that process now with this one, and there's some confusion out there. But what I think what I think parents need to know about marriage is that, first of all, it's a distinctive human good. In other words, marriage is good, and it's distinctive. It's unique. It's one of a kind. It's the only relationship for which the state offers a license, the only friendship relationship, and there's a reason for that. It's not because you couldn't offer a license for other kinds of friendships, but because there isn't a particular need for it. What happens in marriages is people have kids. And in order to sort out the relationships, the financial, the responsibility, the medical, the everything else of who's responsible for the kids, and in order to ensure that the kids have someone who is taking responsibility for them, society has recognized, not created, but recognized that this is a unique relationship that requires unique treatment. But what happened, where it went wrong, in my opinion, is maybe you go back to 1960, 1970, when marriage became, and where relationships in general became kind of focused on just you and me, babe. I use that term in my book. It's a just you and me, babe relationship. Hmm. I talk to people today and I tell them, there was a time that if you got married, you knew you were going to have kids. If you had sexual relationships, whether you were married or not, you thought, wow, we might have kids. You couldn't have a relationship that was just you and me, babe, without in the back of your mind thinking, just you and me, babe, and whoever comes along.
That's right. That's right.
But heterosexual relationships led the way with just you and me, babe. And, it's in our music, it's in the movies, it was in the film. It was all about the romance of the couple. And we lost sight of the fact that we're building for a future. Now, you start with that as a foundation, and it's a very inward-looking view of love. It's not a very outward-giving view of love, even though it feels like love. You start with that as a foundation, and from there to gay marriage, it's a very short slide.
Yeah.
Very short step.
Yes. Yeah, and that I think that's why painting a picture of biblical marriage is so vital, and helping to understand students to understand what marriage is, what of course, if this thing comes from God, then how does, it's a designer. What does he say about the design of it?
Yep.
And helping to students to see this is not just, and I think this is the approach, and this is what you're talking about, is there's this individualistic approach, this kind of westernized approach to love, and therefore to marriage, and to all, and mm-hmm. sexuality, that we
yep.
just import right in, and we've imported it in the church, and even in the church, how we talk about these things, and our views on these things, but when we look at this biblically, I mean, if you were to say, okay, here are the key insights biblically that a parent needs to communicate to their students, what would you say those are?
Well, I would say that marriage is it is rooted in the Scripture all the way back to the first chapter of Genesis, when God created them in man and woman in His image, male and female, He created them, and then shortly after that, he pronounced the institution of marriage into existence by the formula that Jesus repeated in Matthew 19, which is that a man shall leave his mother and father and hold fast to his wife, and they'll be one flesh. And you follow it from the very beginning. Jesus reinforced it as being for man and a woman. And marriage goes all the way to the end of the Bible, too, because the marriage is used as a picture of God's relationship with humans, Jesus Christ's relationship with the church, and the final party that Jesus is going to throw for us in heaven, and for his own glory, is called the marriage supper of the Lamb. And we're the bride of Christ, it says in Ephesians. It says in Ephesians that The relationship between a man and a woman is a reflection of the relationship between Christ and the church. So it's a holy thing. It's ordained by God, and it's It's a loving relationship. It's a covenant relationship, and it's also just by nature designed to be the kind of thing that kids come from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not that every marriage produces kids, but I think that the couples that I've known that didn't have kids and wanted them, they experienced that as a painful loss.
Yeah, yeah, and this goes back to back to Genesis, right? God,
yep.
God's telling us to fill and form His world.
That's
and,
right.
Of course,
yep.
So you know, part of marriage is procreation, and I think this kind of full orbed view is really important. You know, is there kind of a pleasure and recreation in sexuality and marriage? Absolutely. But procreation is part of it. Intimacy and oneness is another key thing. And I think these are things that need to be communicated, because when our young people have a proper view of what marriage is, then now when we look at things that deviate from that, it starts to make sense to them. And so these kind of, key things about marriage, key insights into marriage, inform us about things that, are out of bounds and why God would have these things out of bounds.
Right.
Well, hey, we need to go to a break here, but Tom, this is a fascinating interview. I think it's an important important book you've written here. I'm speaking with author Tom Gilson. He has written a great book called Critical Conversations, A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Their Teens. That's available from Kriegel Publications. And after this break, we'll be back with Tom Gilson to talk more about how we can have this kind of conversation.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
It's hard to keep in mind all the facts and arguments you need to address tough topics. That's why STR has developed a series of quick reference guides on same-sex marriage, abortion, and tactics to help refresh your memory and encourage dialogue. These guides give you concise answers, all on a single 8.5 by 11 inch laminated card. They're a quick and easy way to gain useful knowledge about some of the most important issues facing Christians today. With these tools at your side to guide your thoughts and aid your memory, you'll engage critics with full confidence. You'll be fully equipped to answer objections with grace and clarity. Get your quick reference guides today by visiting the STR store at store.str.org or calling 800-2-REASON.
Welcome back. You are listening to Stand to Reason. I am Brett Kunkel, the Student Impact Director here at Stand to Reason, sitting in for my boss, Greg, who is out there in the wide world traveling somewhere, I think on his way to Florida. And I am having a great conversation here with Tom Gilson. Tom Gilson is a partner in lots of different ministry endeavors in the past. We've been a part of some great groups. He has done some great ministry. He's a senior editor and ministry coordinator of thestream.org right now, which is a great place for content. And he's written a great book, especially for those of you who are parents out there. But I think there's definitely a broad appeal. Anyone who's just wrestling with this particular issue of homosexuality and same-sex marriage, and how do you have some good conversations about this? How do you think clearly about this issue? His book, Critical Conversations, A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Teens, is a book you need to pick up. Tom, I want to look at part two here for a little bit, and it's entitled Navigating the Rocky Relationships. I think you have some good stuff in here in terms of talking with your teen about these questions, some basic principles. What are some of those things? What are some of the principles that a parent needs to be aware of when they're talking with teens about tough questions like homosexuality or same-sex marriage?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. And actually, maybe even there's a prior question, which is why would a parent even want to do this? Because, like we said earlier, it's an awkward topic. And the gay marriage issue has been settled, right? And, you know, it went to the Supreme Court, decision was made. But here's what hasn't happened, is that it hasn't come to a point of settled conviction and confidence and comfort in the minds of our teens who are being torn away from the church by the continuing message that the church and Christianity has been all wrong about this all along. And that's not over yet. And because of that, teens are really, they're drifting away, in some cases being torn away from belief in Christ and relationship with the church. And what I want to say is that this is an opportunity for parents, believe it or not, and it really can be an opportunity to strengthen and deepen your relationship with your teen. And that's the attitude that I think a parent could go into it with. And go into it with knowledge. You need to have some idea what you're talking about. This book isn't that long, by the way. It's an overview of some things that will get you some equipping to get started and not be caught flat-footed by questions and not be worried about that. But go into it with the idea that, you know, this is a relational opportunity. When my kids hit the teenage years, they kind of started saying, oh, do we have to have family devotionals? And, you know, I wish they hadn't said that, but that's who they were. But we didn't quit having family conversations. Instead, we had them over breakfast, or we had them while I was driving them to school, or once in a while I'd take them out to a daddy date with my daughter, or dad time with dad, with my son, and we'd go to McDonald's or something, and we'd just talk. And then the way to open up this conversation is just by asking questions. You mentioned that earlier, mm-hmm. is asking questions. And, you know, what are your friends saying about this topic? Is anybody among your friends kind of bothered by the way Christians have treated this? If you ask about their friends, by the way, that gives them a safe place to answer. If rather than saying, well, what do you think about this? What do you think about their... This is just a little bit safer question for them to answer.
Yeah, in fact, you give a list of specific examples. So if that parent's like, oh, I'm not sure what question to ask, you've actually yep. formulated those questions for them. And yeah, and I like what you've done, because you kind of, it's not maybe a me versus my kid kind of thing. What do you think? But hey, mm-hmm. yeah, what do your friends think? What do you see out there in terms of classmates and what they're saying and how they're discussing it? So those are, I think, great questions. And that's what you say, lead with those questions.
Right.
And after you lead with those questions, what do you have to do?
Listen.
That's right.
And love. And by the way, they might come out with something that you didn't want them to say. Like, you know, my friends think the church is stupid and I do too. And, you know, try to make your sharp intake of breath as subtle as you can make it. And be thankful that they said it out loud.
That's right.
And because if they're not saying it out loud, maybe they're saying it anyway. You want to find out where they are. And then keep listening and say, well, tell me more. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what you think are the big errors that the church is making. Let's just see if we can talk through these things together and love them no matter what. Make it safe, too. You know, if you get the sense that they're giving you one of these safe Jesus loves me, this I know because that's what they told me to say in Sunday school answers, say, well, you know, you can make it even safer by saying something like, well, I'm glad to hear you say that, but I'm kind of surprised too, because I would have thought maybe you would have had something even, you know, something more to say about it than that. Something And it's okay if you surprise me with something that you're not sure I like to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then respond. Don't react. Stay with them. And sure, and whatever you do, you know, take their question seriously. Respect their questions.
Yeah, I think you're right. Oh. If they're getting them out to you, then they've got them inside. And you want them to you want to be the safe place. You don't want them going to their friends and letting their friends, you know, teach them and train mm-hmm. them on this issue. You want them to come to you. And so, yeah, there's that is, I think, such a key insight is that when our kids raise up these issues and when they say things that we don't agree with, that we don't jump on their throats, that we don't get all defensive and all upset about it, but be calm, be a good listener, mm-hmm. and be thankful. I think that is a great perspective. Be thankful that they're sharing that with you, that doubt with you. Because that means that they find you to be a safe place. And in particularly this issue, and one of the reasons why this is such a critical issue is because for a lot of kids, this is an issue that seems to be a wedge between their faith and their friends.
Yeah.
And so this is a big issue. And so they need that space in which to discuss. In fact, some of the research that's been done by Kara Powell in Sticky Faith has talked about the space that kids have for they need space to be able to doubt and express those doubts. So, yeah, this is great.
Yeah, I've seen that. I quote that in the book. It's I think it's powerful and it makes sense. And I have heard horror stories from people who have said, when I was growing up, it wasn't okay in my church or it wasn't okay in my family to ask questions. And I have never heard one of those stories that came out good in the short run. I've heard some where people recovered from it. But the inability to ask questions is at least in the short run, always damaging.
Yeah, yeah.
And so... you know, maybe the kid will ask you, maybe your teen will ask you a question that you don't know the answer to. And my advice on that is to go, whoa, you asked me a tough one. You stumped me. Let's celebrate that. I'm taking you out for ice cream. We're just going to celebrate the fact that you came up with a question I couldn't answer.
Yeah.
And then you say, now that we've done that, what can we do together to find out if there is an answer?
That's right. You don't have to have the answer all the time on the spot.
Right.
But you can actually model for your kids a teachability and to say, I don't know, and to say, hey, let's do some research together. That could have just as big of an impact.
It might be your biggest win ever. It might be better than having the answer.
That's right. That's right. Well, you in part three, and I think this is so valuable in your book, is, you know, you get practical help in the specific challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought what I'd love to do is I want to throw out some of these because I think these are things that parents are going to hear all the time. These are what kids hear, and so this is what they're going to raise. Let me throw out some of these phrases that you list here and then just give our audience a kind of a brief response. Okay, how would you respond to this?
So, okay, you're going to have to tell me what page you're getting it from so I can flip there and read my answer.
Well, we'll start with group A.
And, I hope I'm kidding.
Well, I was hoping you were kidding too, but you know, I wanted to give you
that's right. You're on the spot. You're
the chance
on the radio.
There, you know,
yeah,
but
you know.
but you know, I sometimes I write something and I forget what I've written, so
yeah.
I know it was good, but let me go back and look at it.
Right.
So let's say your kid comes up to you and says, you know, Mom, Dad, I know your position. I know you think homosexuality is wrong, and I think you're homophobic. You guys are just homophobic, right? This is the label that's out there, so they throw that at you.
Yep.
What do you say when your kid calls you homophobic?
Well, I would say that being opposed to something doesn't mean that you've got a pathological problem with it. Homophobia, you know, the word phobia comes from psychology, and it means an irrational or out of proportion level of fear or aversion or hatred. And not every fear is phobic. Not every aversion is pathological. We're opposed to lots of things. We're opposed to casual divorce, but we're not afraid of people who get divorced. And so the word is, the word needs to be identified for what it is. It is an incredibly powerful label that comes out in just a few syllables, and it's a zinger. It's a powerful label. It's rhetorically strong, but it actually trades in terminology that doesn't fit. And I'm not afraid of homosexual. I'm not afraid of gays. Mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of lesbians. I'm not afraid of transgender persons.
Yeah,
I'm just not. I've got good friendships.
Yeah,
it's not a fear issue. It's not an aversion issue.
And I think what you just said there, you have friendships with folks who are gay and lesbian or transgender. And I think if parents can say that, like I know people, I've talked with people. I have friends who are gay. So, I went to lunch with one with one of my gay friends the other day. Kind of thing has to be lived out as well. And that, I think, really helps take the teeth out of that kind of objection.
Yep.
What about this one? Hate is not a family value, because you hear that one a lot. You guys are just, you're haters.
Yeah.
And that's what this is really about.
Sure. Well, to the bumper sticker, hate is not a family value, I'd say, yep. Just, okay, next.
Uh-huh.
Like, why did you even bother to mention that? Well, it's because they have already done the other half of the job, which is they have taken the word hate and they've pinned it on us so it sticks. Mm-hmm. We are the ones who hate. And so they can say hate is not a family value, and your mind automatically goes to the rest of what they didn't say in that phrase, which is hate is not a family value and you hate gays.
Right.
Well, I don't. The hate charge usually comes from the idea that you disagree. You disagree with us. You won't accept us. You don't like what we're doing. Well, if that were the definition of hate, the fact that they disagree with us, they don't accept what we're doing, they don't like what we're doing, would mean that they're haters too. Do they want to carry that label, or do they think it only applies to people that they disagree with? There's a double standard there. And beyond that, there's this other thing too, which is this would happen to me live. It's happened to me on the web. I kind of wish this would happen to me in person, where someone comes to me and says, you know, you're a Christian, you hate gays. I would say, look, you don't know me. I think, you know what, let's go and get coffee. Let's sit down and talk for an hour. Let's talk for 2 hours. And after we've talked for a while, if you still think that I am a hater, then maybe you'll have a basis from which to say that. But until then, you're stereotyping. Do you believe in stereotyping?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes that is an effective way to kind of help people see that they're doing the very thing that they're complaining about you.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, this is good stuff. Tom, when we come back from the break, I want to kind of do some rapid fire here with you. I want to work our way through more of these kinds of statements that you're going to hear from your kids. And I'm here with Tom Gilson. He's the author of Critical Conversations. It's a brand new book that's come out, subtitled A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Teens. This is something that is vital for parents who are trying to raise up and disciple kids in the 21st century. When we come back from break, we'll have more of this conversation with author Tom Gilson.
You can connect with STR on social media to keep up to date on all the latest, including articles, videos, events, and giveaways. You'll easily find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, Instagram, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff. Post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians, weigh in by responding to some of the issues of the day, and see what's going on behind the scenes. Social media is your gateway to all the latest from STR, including speaking events, new podcasts, resources, articles, and what's on our mind today. Follow STR online and find all our social media platforms when you visit str.org. Click Get Connected at the top of the page.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STR e-news from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on Subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Thanks for listening to Stand to Reason. I'm Brett Kunkel, the Student Impact Director here at Stand to Reason, sitting in for Greg. And I want to make you aware of a great opportunity, if you do not already know this, but in 2016, Stand to Reason is taking a cruise. August 6th through the 13th, we will be doing an Alaskan Cruise Conference. We're not just cruising just for entertainment's sake, but this is, I guess, cruising with a purpose. Greg Kunkel, our good friend Jay Warner Wallace, and our friend John Stonestreet are all going to be on the Stand to Reason cruise doing sessions, teaching and training. And then the great thing about a cruise like this is that there is lots of interaction that happens outside of the classroom. So you get to know these guys, maybe have breakfast with them, talk with them as you see them out and about. And it's just a great time of just kind of teaching and training and discussion and conversation. So I want to encourage you to go to str.org and click on the cruise banner to find out all the information for our Stand to Reason cruise. Well, I'm having a great conversation with author Tom Gilson. He's written a book that's just come out, Critical Conversations, A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Your Teens. That's from Kriegel. Tom, if someone wants to get that book, where do they go?
They can go to Amazon, look for it, Kriegel Publications website. They can go to criticalconversationsbook.com. Those are three places they can go. It should be in bookstores, I hope, next week.
Great, great. And one of the most helpful things I think about this book is this the part three, where you list these different slogans, these different kind of objections that you're probably going to hear from your kid. And so I want to go through some more of these in our last segment here. And Tom, I just give you a chance to kind of summarize, you know, an answer. What do you say? So for instance, your kid says, and this is, you hear this slogan kind of all the time in the media, but you are on the wrong side of history, Mom and Dad. What do you say to that?
Well, I'd say that tomorrow's opinions are a bad guide to today's truth. That's the first thing. There have been a lot of historical inevitabilities that turned out not to be so. For example, 100 years ago, it was very much the scientific and right thing to do to be talking about limiting reproductive rights for people who were, quote, imbeciles or morons, or the lesser classes. It was called eugenics. And it was the right side of history to be on the side of eugenics, to sterilize people against their will. Well, you know, that turns out to be that history isn't the tomorrow's news headlines and ethics books haven't been written yet. Really, history has got an awful lot going for it in terms of the thousands and thousands of years that we have always universally believe that marriage is for a man and a woman.
Okay. So maybe, all right.
You can't get tomorrow's opinion yet.
Yeah, okay, well, but today's you know, progressive value here is equality. We know equality is the right thing, and so you're just against equality.
I'm just against equality, so are you. Everybody is against marriage equality, and everybody is for it, in this sense, that no matter who you're talking to about marriage equality, if you push them far enough, they will say, well, no, that doesn't count as marriage. You might be talking about marriage between a brother and a sister, or marriage between large groups of people, or father-daughter or that kind of a thing. And they say, no, that's not marriage. And you say, oh, you don't believe in marriage equality. And they'll say, well, I believe in marriage equality up to a point. And I'll say, oh, well, so do I. And then we start arguing about where that point is. And then I will say, okay, did you notice we quit arguing over equality and now we're discussing where marriage reaches its limit? Mm-hmm. The disagreement isn't over equality. The disagreement is over the limit. Can we talk about that instead? And that's this is important because equality is just driven deep into the American psyche is like this incredibly important virtue. And so if they can spring that on us and use it, you know, it's got incredible emotional power, but it's actually not the issue. So let's try to get off that topic because it doesn't fit. It's not the right topic.
Okay, so yeah, let's get off that. But the gay people don't choose to be gay. So how do you answer that, Dad?
Well, that doesn't determine whether it's right or wrong. You don't choose all of your options in life. And whether it's inborn or not, whether it's nature or nurture, by the way, the research on that is very mixed, very inconclusive. It's probably both. And there's a lot in there that nobody understands anyway. So does that mean that what is clearly wrong is all of a sudden okay for those people? No. There are other inborn tendencies that people have, whether it's a tendency towards towards alcoholism, that it's not right just because it's inborn. The Bible says that sin is the problem we all have and we're born with it. That doesn't make sin right for all of us, generally speaking.
Now, Tom, do you think in this part of the conversation, it may be helpful to distinguish between the behavior and the attraction for students?
Yep.
Because I think, you know, we didn't choose to be gay. This term gay could be ambiguous. What exactly do you mean by that? Because I think you've got kids that will say, well, that means, they identify with the gay lifestyle and kind of endorse it. But then there are those, I mean, there's kind of a spectrum there. There are students who maybe struggle with same-sex attraction who wouldn't identify as gay. And that distinction might be helpful in sorting some of this out, don't you think?
I do. And so this is where one of those question-asking things comes in, which is, what do you mean when you say gay? We didn't choose to be gay. Let's talk about what that means. You can talk about it in vague generalizations. They didn't choose to be gay. It might be more helpful to say, well, let's talk about someone that you're actually talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, look, gay and lesbian couples, can't they be just as good of parents as a straight couple? So why would we take away their ability to get married?
Well, In the short run, a gay couple adopting a child who wouldn't have been adopted otherwise, that might be kind of okay for the child. And I've heard that argument. In the long run, what that does is it reinforces a culture that says marriage isn't very crucial and very central to who we are as a people. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You're going to have more kids who need parents. Who need adopting, you're going to have more broken homes where kids are going to be in that position. Besides which, the research that says that that gay couples, same-sex couples, can be just as good parents as a mom and dad, either biological or adoptive, that research is really shoddy. It's fraught with problems of what they call convenience samples, small samples, and it's very poorly done. There is, as yet, no really good research showing anything conclusive about this, because, and there won't be. There won't be for 40 years, because the answer to the question whether these same-sex couples are just as good parents, that answer won't become until their kids have kids. This is a huge, huge long-term social experiment. And anybody who says that they've got one answer or another is wrong, except for this. We've got a lot of experience that says that being raised by mom and dad is actually really good.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's where a lot of these objections kind of have that short-sightedness where it's like, how's the gay couple who live next door to you, how are they hurting you? And so you're kind of pulling back here and saying, well, here's how they might be hurting me over the long term and hurting others. Okay, well, you have like a third group here of questions and objections regarding God and the Bible.
Right.
And this is one that you hear a lot, and not just from students, but adults as well. But they'll say something like, I read the Gospels. Jesus never said anything about homosexuality. He didn't speak out against it.
Well, Jesus never said anything about rape or incest. He didn't come out against internet piracy. There's a lot of things Jesus didn't say. But in the case of this one, for one thing, Jewish culture at the time, in which he was thoroughly immersed, was very thoroughly clear on this question that sexual acts were wrong. And you would have heard that from the rabbinical schools of his time. So he just didn't need to say it any more than he needed to say that rape was wrong. People already had that answer clearly in mind. And on the other hand, he strongly affirmed marriage as being between a man and a woman. So it doesn't mean a lot. The whole Bible is God's word. It isn't just the red letters. Anyway.
Yeah, and that's, I think if you also kind of look at who Jesus was as a good observant Jew, even though we don't have something recorded directly about homosexuality in the scriptures, we would know what his view was.
Sure.
Given that he's a Jew. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, how about this objection? Even in the Bible, you don't always have one man with one woman. You've kind of said this is the biblical foundation, but that's not the case, is it?
Actually, in a way it is. Even polygamous marriages in the Bible and in most of culture have been man with woman. The women were not married to each other. They were married to the man. So that's one part of the answer. And the other part of the answer is that, yeah, you've got some examples of polygamous marriages in the Bible, and there may be an exception or two, but actually, almost without fail, they turned out bad. So is that our example of a good marriage? No. Mm-hmm. It's an example of just, it tells what happened. It doesn't affirm it as being the right thing. It's just saying that this is what happened.
That's right. What's described is not necessarily prescribed.
There you go.
So, okay, well, and here's another big one that I hear from young people, and they hear from maybe their atheist or, skeptical friend, but you Christians, you eat shellfish,
yeah.
you wear mixed
right?
fabrics, you do these things that the Bible prohibits you from doing, so why then do you say no to homosexuality when you do these other things? It's kind of this apparent inconsistency.
Right. Well, the Bible doesn't say that every command in the Bible is applicable to everybody for all time. In the Old Testament, yeah, there are prohibitions against wearing mixed fabrics. There are prohibitions against eating shellfish. The mixed fabrics thing is, I'll come back to that in a moment. The shellfish thing was probably a cultural thing. There are very different kinds of taboos around the world. But that one was repealed by Jesus and by the Word of God in the New Testament in Peter's experience with the, I think it was in Acts 10, where God declared all foods clean. So the shellfish thing was repealed. The mixed fabric thing, I don't understand. I don't get why it's in there. But as one author, and I'm having trouble remembering if it's David Lamb or John Lamb who wrote this, he said, consider what would happen if 1,000 years from now somebody, an archaeologist, dug up a church and found a bulletin that said that you shouldn't read Sports Illustrated in March. Mm-hmm. What in the world would be wrong with reading a sports magazine in March? Well, you'd have to know the culture well enough to know when the swimsuit issue comes out. There's probably a really good reason that for this prohibition against wearing mixed fabrics, and we probably don't know it, because guess what? It was a long time and a long distance away from where we are right now. And if we don't know something, that doesn't tell us that the things that we do know are therefore wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And these things are given to a particular people in a particular place.
Yep.
At a particular time. So, okay, a couple more here, Tom.
Sure.
How about the New Testament? New Testament isn't talking, when it gives its prohibitions against homosexual behavior, it's not talking about committed monogamous same-sex marriage relationships.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this comes from Matthew Vines. He's not the one who originated it, but he's the most popular person on the internet and in his book who really pushed on this. And the claim is that there were particular kinds of homosexual relationships that Paul knew about and he was writing against in Romans 1 and in 1 Timothy and so on. But he didn't know about, you know, gay marriage. He didn't know about that kind of good gay relationship. Well, it turns out that there are historical reasons to believe that that's wrong. There were committed monogamous same-sex relationships that Paul would have known about. It was especially true in the Greek era, a few hundred years before then, and Paul would have still known about it. But it was also going on some in the time of the first century. So that's just wrong that Paul didn't know about these things. Plus, I think it's just kind of suspicious that nobody ever came up with that as being a way to look at the New Testament until somebody had kind of an axe to grind and was, you know, had a convenient need to find it there.
Yeah.
So,
this is good stuff. In fact, speaking with Tom Gilson, author of Critical Conversations. And we just kind of went through a number of the objections or the questions that a parent's going to get from their kid. They're going to kind of regurgitate a lot of the stuff from the culture. And parents have got to be equipped. And so Tom's book is a great resource on this. Tom, thanks for joining me for this conversation.
Oh, you're welcome.
The book is Critical Conversations, A Christian Parent's Guide to Discussing Homosexuality with Teens, written by author Tom Gilson. That's Kriegel Publishers. Tom is the senior editor and ministry coordinator with thestream.org. Get that book and get equipped to have good conversations. This is Brett Kunkel, and you've been listening to Stand to Reason.
Been listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.